charge it up. That's usually the only failure point they have on these. By the way, the Kelvin name is also used. It's interchangeable. I found that too, Dick. You're calling it the Joule Kelvin. You're right with that. For some reason, they're calling it that. Most of the times, it's Joule Thompson unit. But they said if without this, for instance, without this big shade as big as the tennis court, facing the sun and keeping the telescope on a cool side at 40 degrees Kelvin, to do that without the shades and everything, they would have had to send, they have to weigh it, tons and tons of helium up there if they were going to use the tank system, similar to what they use on Spitzer. Spitzer's an infrared telescope that has about 100 gallons. He gave it to me in liters, and I converted it. Roughly, it looks like it comes out to about a 100-gallon tank, and it's still doing quite well after many years of operation. Still got a lot of helium left on board that, but it's nowhere near the size of this thing. This thing's like sending a building out to four times the distance from the moon. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N. And by the way, I just wanted to mention that I can be reached at ARRL, my call letter at ARRL.net. Sometimes I forget to give that out. Back to you, Dick. WHYY.
Joe recognized. Going to go over to you in a second, Joe. The Spitzer telescope discovered a Earth-like planet, slightly larger in size, as I remember, a little bit closer to the star. But it discovered it by the old-fashioned technique, the wobble. In other words, it looked at the Doppler shift of the lines of emission of that star and recognized the fact that a planet is going around that star 20 light years away from us, whereas the Kepler telescope looks for a planet that occults the star, goes in front of the star and dims it a little bit. And that technique is a lot more sensitive, is the good news. The bad news is it only finds the planets that line up exactly in line with us. In other words, their orbital plane has to be directly in line with us as a flat disk so that the planet goes directly in front of the star. So you only find, I'm going to pick a number, 1% of the planets by that technique, whereas the wobble technique that Spitzer uses, it can find all of the planets. That's the good news. The bad news is it's more sensitive to the planets that are closer to the star. Because the planets that are closer create a greater wobble of the star. The planets that are further away have a much longer period, and the way we declare that we have found a planet is that when you see something like two orbits, just one sudden blip in the data, you say, well, that's a planet candidate, but you confirm it when you see it do the exact same thing the second time around. So wouldn't you like to have a cryogenically cooled detector which has a 20 dB more sensitivity, Joe? W-A-2-R-Y-Y-K-2-R-I-W in the segment.
There you go. You remember the qualities eventually. My question is, on this telescope that's going to be launched in 2018 or something like that, the James Webb telescope, and this also has to do with other spacecraft that are out there, what form of propulsion system do they use to steer the thing? And especially with that one, since it's going to be near Earth, like a million miles away, how do they refuel this propulsion system? A way of steering the thing in different directions that's done by some means. How does that get refueled, or is that on some sort of system where it lasts for a very, very long amount of time? Back to you.
Yeah, I'm about to turn it over to Paul. I'm pretty sure it's going to be the second. There's not going to be any planned repair mission or planned refueling mission to Lagrange Point number 2, a million miles behind the Earth and the other side from the sun. It's a very difficult place to get to. So I'm guessing there are reaction control jets on board and enough fuel to power those for the next 10 or 20 years to do station keeping. And I think it's going to slowly wander around that that Lagrange point number 2. Is that roughly it, Paul? WS2M, K2RIW.
Yeah, and it's called the Halo Orbit. Just kind of like moves around 100,000 miles, you know, from one end to the other, and just kind of stays out there. As the Earth pulls it around, it'll stay at that orbit, which is nice. So you don't need that much fuel. It's got all its reaction jets. It's got its gyros. It's got the electronics. It's got the compressor for the cryogenics. All located on the warm side of the spacecraft, so it does have, like Dick says, a lot of fuel on board, and all the jets are located, on the rear side of this thing, and it does have gyros on board, so they'll be utilizing them, keep it back, you know, at certain different angles, and it does have a going to call it a wing. What should we call this thing? It's a piece that sticks out of the back of the spacecraft, again on the warm side, looking at the sun. And it's going to pick up the either solar wind or I guess photons, but more likely the solar wind. I think I've read both, but it's going to hit this panel, and this panel has an actuator on it, one way or the other, and that will help stabilize and keep the spacecraft in one position, free, you know, pretty much free, because you won't use fuel, or you won't have to power up gyroscopes or anything like that. They expect the use of this telescope to last 10 years, and naturally anything after that is going to be gravy. Back to you, Dick.
And there's good reason to believe that the James Webb Infrared Telescope is going to give us pictures almost as exciting as the Hubble Space Telescope. And from the American public's point of view, or just the general public's point of view, Hubble is probably the most productive piece of hardware that NASA has ever produced. Lots and lots of people identify with that, even more than they identify with the Apollo 11 landing on the moon, the first man on the moon, Neil Armstrong. I think more people know Hubble than Armstrong. And Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins. Not very many people know the name of Collins, the guy who stayed in the command service module orbiting the moon while Armstrong and Aldrin went down to the surface. But he was very important. They had to have a place to go back to and to redock in order to come back home. Somebody had to keep everything working correctly on the main spacecraft. Very important guy, and yet I'll bet you a lot of people don't know him. So this Joule Thompson, or Joule Kelvin refrigerator, I'm going to call it, has this expansion piece of capillary tubing. I guess one of the failure mechanisms of that kind of a refrigerator, let me drop it, because you're actively compressing that gas. Just a matter of time before you start making some metal chips if the lubrication is not perfect. And your compressor, when it makes metal chips, can start jamming up the system. So they're planning on 10 years. They'll declare it success if it lasts for 10 years. You and I know Hubble, I think, when I pass it back to you, Paul, I'm going to ask you, what was the original planned lifetime for Hubble? I'll bet you originally had it lasted 5 years. Would consider it a success. And I think it was launched, I'm going to make a guess, 1990, in that order, 25 years ago. And I think we've had 5 or 6 repair missions. So I think Hubble is on, it's like a cat with 9 lives. I think we've used up 5 or 6 of those lives, haven't we, Paul? Not Hubble. WS2N, K2LIW.
I know, 2009 was the last flight out there. Remember, they weren't going to do that after Columbia. They said, that's it. We're only going to the space station. That's it. This is too dangerous. We have to look at all the tiles and And I said, well, very important. You know, we got to do our service mission number 5. And they did. They went out there. That was the one with Mike Massimino. They decided that the handler on Hubble was in the way, and they needed to get in there to replace all these. Oh, there were 32 little screws they were going to take apart, change out the computer board and all. This one thing, they tried to back out the screws, and it was all stripped, and nothing was going to work. So they tested it out on the ground. Let's see if we can break that duplicate handle on the ground. And they did, and they gave Massimino, a New Yorker, I believe, job of doing this, and he ripped that thing right off. That was, in 09, and at the time, I remember them saying that they hoped to get around 7 years out of it. Well, everything's still working. It's still got 4 gyroscopes on board, and solar panels are still putting out power, and everything's updated. Looking at the Hubble Space Telescope, it kind of looks the same, but they said none of it is the same except for the mirror. I mean, it's all been changed. When they change out pieces there, you look at the old pictures of Story Musgrave and those guys going in there with these refrigerator-sized pieces of equipment, opening up doors and pulling old stuff out and putting these big things in. Five EVAs on the first service mission to fix that thing, to bring it back to life. Went from the biggest laughing stock for NASA to the biggest, in my opinion, biggest success for scientific discoveries. We didn't even know how big the universe was officially, how old the universe was until all this information came back. And looking at black holes instead of just saying, well, maybe they're out there, on and on and on. Back to you, Dick, K2RA, WWS2N.
Yeah, I just looked up Hubble. It was launched on 1990, so it is now 25 years, 3 months, some odd days, something like that. Gotten our money's worth out of that one, my goodness. And when Story Musgrove replaced that whole optical assembly, rectangle, so to speak, so they could refocus itself, you called that refrigerator size. I remember the size of that object he was maneuvering. I would say it was closer to the size of a grand piano. It had the shape almost of a grand piano. What a maneuver that was. He really pushed his luck on coming close to dying during that mission because of the amount of time he extended the life support system that he was wearing. Ran out of breathable air, ran out of the emergency tank on board, and when he was in the airlock, had to use the hose in the airlock, hook it up to his spacesuit in order to continue breathing while the airlock was being repressurized. That's really pushing it to the limit. On top of that, I attended that lecture by Story Musgrove that was given at the Cradle of Aviation Museum about 4 or so years ago. The Astronomical Society of Long Island made an arrangement with him where he gave a talk. Let me drop it. And he described what he went through, what it was really like being on that mission. His fingers got frozen. They no longer have any feeling. His body was exposed to an amount of radiation such that his chances of getting cancer for the rest of his life is at least doubled. He knew all the risks he was taking, and he believed that that mission was worth it. He was willing to make that dedication. Really dedicated guy. That repair mission was supposed to be 2 separate shuttle flights, and he says, I can name that tune in one note. he's saying, if my people practice enough, we're going to do all of that in one mission, and he managed to squeeze it in just barely. And yeah, and some of those repair missions, they ran into some ridiculous problems of stuck bolts and sheared things and whatever.
Kathy Thornton with the solar panel.
Yeah, tell us about that solar panel. You have to worry about the sharp edges. If you cut a hole in your spacesuit, that can be game over real fast. So Give us some words on that solar panel replacement, Wes. There we go. Paul, WS2N, KQIW.
Yeah, they wanted to put different solar panels on there. The new ones were 30% more efficient, a little smaller than the originals. And they folded up one, got it into the shuttle bay, and put the other one on. But the other one, you know, each spacecraft has two solar panels. So the other one, they couldn't fold it back up, and wouldn't fold back up, no matter what they did. What do we do with this thing? So they decided to, you know, throw it overboard. So on the end of the cargo bay door, you know, those cargo bay doors open on the shuttle, so everything's all open. And when they're working on this thing, they got Kathy Thornton up there, and she got a hold of this whole big solar panel, let it go, and it all but went. And it looked like it was flapping in the breeze as it went toward Earth. Eventually, a couple of weeks later, it picked up some atmosphere and burnt up. That was an incredible sight, and that's what I remember about her spacewalk. And now she's running, she's head of NOAA now, Kathy Thornton. She's still around. Back to you, Dick.
Now, I think you mentioned that the James Webb is going to do some of its steering. Instead of burning up the consumable called reaction control jet fuel, it's going to be doing some of that steering by way of these panels, these flappers, let's say, that you open and close, or you steer them, and therefore the solar wind hitting them gives you steering. And I think that's approximately what they're doing with the Kepler telescope. Kepler 2 is no longer using reaction control wheels, which have worn out. They're doing, they're steering it with little panels, I think, and or the solar panels. So if I understand correctly, the Kepler 2 mission is not aimed at the same position anymore. It's aimed at another point in space, I think. And if James Webb is going to be doing that kind of steering, then you really get it for free. You don't have to use up consumable reaction control jets to do it. And I know that they didn't have the ability to do that on Voyager, because Voyager is out there so far that the solar wind is starting to blow in the wrong direction, so to speak. You wouldn't be able to do that. But I'd like to believe the majority of steering of James Webb will be done by these flappers, and I think that's the main method of steering Kepler right now. Give us some words on that one, Paul. WS2M, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, well, I know Kepler can't move them. It's not designed for that. James Webb will set up for it. And it looks like about, I'm going to call it, doesn't look that big, maybe 8 foot by 8 foot. I'm going to say that's about the size hanging off the bottom part of James Webb. Kind of looks like a solar panel. Who knows, maybe they do have some solar cells on there to pick up sun, but I didn't read that. But yeah, it looks like a big flat solar panel, and they will use that to fine-tune it. Without it, the solar wind would constantly keep moving the spacecraft, so that this will cut back on the use of the thrusters and use of the gyros. And Kepler, I finally found one website that shows a good picture of how they're using the sun to control the attitude of Kepler. It came up on my tablet, and I was looking at it, and I just can't get a clear picture on it, so I didn't want to send it to you. I'm going to send it over to my big computer and see what it looks like. And if that picture's good, I'll send it over to you, Dick. It shows the orbit. You know, Kepler and Spitzer, they're in Earth-trailing orbits. Every year that goes by, it drifts like another one-tenth of an AU behind us, so as time goes on, it'll be eventually, you know, three-tenths or four-tenths of an AU behind us. Right now, Spitzer, it's roughly at 90 degrees in relation to where we are, following us around the sun, and Kepler's not that far away. But it's always looking out away from the sun, and so will James Webb. James Webb will be, you know, I mean, they could look up, pretty much stare at one space for almost all the time, but when they're looking out away from the sun, as the year goes by, they'll basically have four different main locations that they'll be looking at. So that's what Kepler is doing, and it's got the surface of it, flat surfaces, I think about four or five panels that are tight against the body of the telescope, so you don't have these big wings sticking out. It doesn't look like Hubble. It doesn't look like big long wings sticking out like the Juno spacecraft or 60 feet long things. These things are tight, bolted to the frame of the telescope. So you do have a point, an edge on them where two flat surfaces come together. You take those flat surfaces and point that toward the sun, which is the backside of it, and have the solar wind constantly coming out and pushing against that piece, and you could adjust it. It's just like, you know, trying to balance pointed objects on a like sand. If you put it in a big, on a beach, you put it on the sand. If you just put it right, it'll stay balanced. They make some adjustments now and then if it goes out of whack, but it's a lot better than nothing. There's four reaction wheels. You need three to have a good spacecraft, and two of them quit. So they are still able to use two of them to help them move things, adjust things one way or the other. But without the third one, they're confined to using the system. They call it K2, Kepler 2. Bring it back to life. Like a submarine coming back up again and again. Back to you, Dick.
So, first of all, I'm not quite sure what gets moved on Kepler in order to do steering. And second of all, I'm not sure what is the source of power for James Webb. When I look at the pictures of James Webb, I see the five layers of the heat shield on the back side of it. Tell me there's also some flappers out there, and I believe that. And I don't see solar panels, and I haven't heard that James Webb has a nuclear power supply. Where's the main power coming for James Webb, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
There's solar panels there. I know that. No, it does not have an RTG, radioisotope thermoelectric generator. Doesn't have that. Does have solar panels. I'll have to look at the both up of it. Not doing that now. But, and it does only have this one panel. It's not multiple panels that they're going to be using to, sail-like way of moving things. Just one square flat panel. You see it toward the bottom of the spacecraft. And then the jets are away from the, they're not on the coal side, they're supposed to be on the back side. And they'll be hydrazine is the most common fuel that they use on board all these spacecraft. Back to you.
Are the solar panels on James Webb on the hot side, on the back side of those five sun shields, is that where the solar panels? When I look at the pictures on Wikipedia, I don't see the solar panels. I don't see the solar voltaic cells to hold ahead.
Well, maybe one of them is attached to that deflecting, maneuvering shield, I'll call it. I don't know. But, if you read about the capped-on material, on the other side they have it's reflecting like a mylar almost, an aluminum, very shiny, to reflect the sun back away from the spacecraft. They don't want any heat. So it's not part of the sunshade system. It's part of the body of the spacecraft somewhere.
Yeah, solar panels, I think, tend to give off heat. So they'd have to be on the hot side. And yet when I see pictures of the hot side, I don't see those solar panels. Any idea how many watts total? Voyager, by the way, I think, has three separate RTGs. Yes, I think there's three separate RTGs on the Voyager. No nuclear on James Webb. So you and I believe it is solar panels, and how many watts? And so to make a comparison, how many watts are they getting out of the solar panels on the Hubble Space Telescope, if you happen to know? Over you, Paul, KQRIW.
That's a couple of thousand watts on Hubble. I don't know what the wattage is for the James Webb. I don't remember ever coming across that. That kind of thing usually sticks in my head. three RTGs, radioisotope thermoelectric generators. Each one is 103 watts on board Voyager. You have two of them on New Horizon. Very effective, putting out almost 200 watts total. These things have been used for years. They used them on only Ulysses spacecraft, which went into polar orbit around the sun. They've used them on all the Pioneer spacecraft, which are also exiting the solar system. So they're very useful. They used it on Apollo 12, part of the package that they put on the moon. Keep those things running. A lot of people don't realize that they were also on Viking, the Viking missions for Mars Lander. They landed two of them back in the 70s, and they lasted for one of them went 6 years. So, and of course now you got another one on Mars, the Curiosity, is also running an RTG. It's the way to go, but they don't have that on a. I guess the last thing they wanted was more radiation or heat, a lot of heat on the for the thermal blankets for would be on James Webb. They don't want heat on that thing, Dick.
Yeah, that thing has to keep a cool head. To repeat what Wes was saying earlier, the guy who ran, the main guy, the spark plug behind all of those antenna gain contests, as we called them, that were run by the East Coast VHS Society starting in roughly 1968 and have been carried on every single year ever since now by way of Central States VHS Society, the Microwave Update, almost any of the microwave groups that get together to make sure they have an antenna gain competition to find out what the commercial antennas and the ham homebrew antennas are doing. Because in general, the commercial antennas are kind of mediocre in performance, but the main spark plug was Paul Wade. Paul Charles Wade, WA2ZZF was his original call letters. When he moved up to New England, he became N1BWT, and then after that, he became W1 Gigahertz, Whiskey 1, Golf Hotel Zulu. And he has a column in QST Magazine almost every month on the microwave subject, W1 Gigahertz. And so, Paul's a good guy. I spent a lot of time in his house. I used to stay at his house for the weekend when they had these antenna gain competitions because I would take all of my competitive antennas and other hardware and drive all the way down to Saddlebrook, New Jersey. I think that's the name. He lived in Somerville, New Jersey. Lived in Somerville, New Jersey, close to Saddlebrook Park. So my whole family would go down there and spend the weekend with him and his wife, Beth. And now he's living up in Vermont. I think he's in Cabot, Vermont. But a microwave guy from way back. Let me drop it. Whenever the news group, New England Northeast Week Signal Society news group, once a year they hold a competition nowadays, and Paul's the main spark plug behind this, where guys will all bring their 10 gigahertz homebrew equipment. And sometimes as many as 20 guys will show up with equipment, and they set it up in this picnic area, and a guy out in a tent, 200 feet away, has an extremely weak signal generator with a step attenuator, and we all do a competition as to who can hear the weakest signal. So everybody aims their dish at that tent, and he starts cranking down the... Actually, it's the other way around. They crank up the signal generator, step attenuator, to see who first picks it up. They really should do it the other way around, because finding the signal is a big problem. A human hearing system can hear a weak tone in the north. hear it. But if you suddenly spin the dial on the receiver and then try to re-find that signal when it's super weak, that's very difficult. That's a very slow process to find a weak signal. But to keep your brain focused on that signal when you know where it is in the audio spectrum, because the receiver is not drifting, or it's drifting slowly, that's a fun thing to do. So all these guys who are building 10 gig portable equipment, they now get them measured every single year at the New England Weak Signal Society meeting, which takes place, I think, in August or September. I don't know if it has happened yet this year. I got to check on that. Let me drop this. So, among the ham radio operators, 10 gigs and now 22 gigs. They're starting to do the same thing on the 22 gig ham band. A fair amount of moon bounce has taken place on 10 gigs. I think very little has occurred on the 21 gig band, or is it 24 gigs? I think it's called 24 gigs. What's really amazing is that we ham radio operators are given free of charge a whole lot of frequency spectrum, every single octave of the band. If you think about it, 160, 80, 40, 60, 180, 40, 20, 15, 17, 10, there's another one in between there, 2 meters, 6 meters, 2 meters, 220, 440, 1296, I call it, 2 gigs, 3 gigs, 5 gigs. You notice every single octave, we have a whole lot of megahertz given to us free of charge. Anything we build in our own hands to use on that band is automatically type accepted. It's legal to use, if you know what I mean. If you built it or modified it with your own hands. Let me drop it. So that's one hell of a resource. Set up a taxi cab company in your town, and you go on a waiting list for a frequency to run your dispatching. Suddenly realize how valuable frequencies are, and hams are given. Just the 10 gig ham band alone, 10.0 to 10.5. The ham band given to us on 10 gigs is 500 megahertz wide. Imagine the kinds of experiments you can run in there with wideband modulation techniques, if that's what you want to do, frequency hopping techniques, and so on. We've all settled on the main frequency we use there of 10.368. Where'd that number come from? It's the 72 harmonic of 144 megs. The first time you get on 10 gigs, the easiest way to find out if your receiver is working is you listen to the 72nd harmonic of your 2-meter rig, and the 2-meter rig is transmitting at 144 megahertz. So all the upper ham bands are related to some harmonic of 144. I think I got that right. Yeah. One of the highest ham bands that have been used to date is the 243 gigahertz band, which I think is the 1,680 harmonic of 144, something like that. To listen to that higher harmonic out of your 2-meter rig, that's not so easy. You better put it into a diode multiplier, and you better hope the rate of drifting is real low. And get some of the really serious microwave guys. Let me drop it. WA1MBA, Dr. Tom Williams, and his famous saying, he puts at the end of each one of his emails, is no frequency is high enough. I think he alternates between no frequency is high enough, or I'm trying to think of what the other one he writes down. Can't think of it all of a sudden. Another one that means the same thing. And the real progress takes place at the higher frequencies. It has happened over and over again. HF frequencies were given to the ham radio operators way back in the old days because everyone thought that they were useless. Boy, did they have they got their face on that one. I think we've... I wonder if you guys have got any further questions for Paul on space-related stuff. New Horizons. James Webb. James Webb, I think the mirror on James Webb is something like 21 feet in diameter. Boy, is that a mirror. Is that going to hear things? So you have the super sensitive detector, and a super large mirror, and a telescope you can aim at anything in the world that you want, anything in the universe, and it's going to be on the backside of the Earth where... at least certain portions of the year it's going to be shielded. The Earth is going to be providing a shield between it and the Sun, as well as it's got five of these Mylar shields of its own on board. And by way of its inertial wheels and everything else, I think it can be aimed at almost anything you like in all possible directions. Isn't that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, well, or most directions, depending on time of year, you know, it's going to be going around the sun. The spacecraft has solar panels, like a little over, well, they give it in millimeters, a little over 6,000 millimeters, so roughly 6 meters, so you look at 21 feet long. Panels coming off the main bus of the, like I said, the back of the spacecraft, right near all the control jets and everything. So you have to find a close-up view. You're looking for big panels, you're not going to see it. Roughly about 21 feet long. Like two of them coming right off the main bus. It doesn't say how many watch it, I'll have to look for that. But you can figure that out. You know, it's not like, you know, it's, I just don't see the width on the panels. But, you know, my guess is the width is probably, a meter each on each one. And the question you asked me was what? Now I've forgotten. I'm talking about the panels. What question was that, Dick?
I'm not sure. Maybe it was the total number of watts. What you and I can do is calculate the number of square meters of the solar panels, multiply that by 10%, maybe 15%. That's a rough approximation of how many watts they're going to get out of the solar panels. The sun gives you 1,300 watts per square meter of raw energy. 10% of that would be 130 watts. So if you use 150 watts per square meter, I think it would be a rough approximation as to how much power they're going to get out of the solar panels. Back to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, they don't need much. I mean, they need enough to run that compressor. They need enough to transmit back. And, of course, the antenna, by the way, is on the hot side, the 180-degree side. Nothing on the cold side except for the telescope itself, the detectors, and that's pretty much it. And even the actuators, they're trying to keep anything that moves the telescope around is trying to keep that away from the detectors themselves. And the, remember reading, it's not really going to be in the shadow of the Earth that much. You know, you think, well, the Earth's out there and it's going to be always in the shadow. I mean, the reason they want to put this so far away from the Earth is to get away from the infrared heat that the moon and the Earth give off. That's the name of the game there. That's the reason for the location. So that's important. Not anything else. Everything has to do with being cold. So I want to see this thing unfold. That's what I want to see. It's going to take a couple of months to get out to its location, and it's going to be a slow process of, you know, opening up the scope itself. It's all folded up. I mean, a thousand things could go wrong here. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's a little bit scary. I don't know the exact number. What's the approximate number of estimation these days of total price of James Webb? Did I remember it around $8 billion in that order, Paul? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, $8 billion. You could build, I guess, 3 Tappan Zee bridges for this, for this money. It's a big expense, but it's spread out over, 10 years or so. It's less than $1 billion a year. Big money, but, I guess it's self-insured. They have a lot of faith in the Ariane rocket by the European Space Agency. It's not pretty good. They have a good success record with that thing.
Yeah, that's good news. They got a good record. It turns out that when you build a piece of hardware like this, the biggest chunk of money is developing all the techniques. The actual price of the raw ingredients is somewhat minor by comparison. So if in the worst case that Ariane goes into the ocean, you have to replace the hardware. The next time you replace that hardware is not $8 billion, it's a much smaller number. Do you hear anything along the lines of them saying that there's going to be spare hardware just in case the first one and the launch fails, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW?
No,
surprised if they came up with a with another one, a twin. You know, I mean, they talked about that with the docking colony. It just went, you know, blew up from the Falcon 9. They're going to install a docking collar to the International Space Station, and there was there's a second one that's also planned to go up. Well, yeah, there was a third one, and now they're rushing to, you know, they did have extra parts for that, so they're rushing to put one together for that. That's doable, but something like this, it's pretty costly. They always did years ago. Everything had, they had two of everything, pretty much. You know, that's why you had the two Voyages and the two Viking missions and the two Pioneer missions that went out past the solar system. But then that got a little costly, and they started cutting back on that. Two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. Now you've got Curiosity riding around. They said no backup for that. But you know what? They have one that looks just like Curiosity that's going up in 2020. It's called the 2020 Mars rover right now. No name. It's being built, and you'll see that launched in 5 years. So that's kind of like a backup.
And I'll bet it's going to have a lot more capability. James Webb is going to be mounted roughly a million miles behind the Earth at what's called Lagrange Point Number 2. You said they chose that in order to be away from the heat of the Moon and the Earth. That's true. But that Lagrange Point Number 2 is almost exactly 1 million miles behind the Earth. It decides that you only get mounted 500,000 miles or 1.5 million miles, and you're not at the Lagrange Point. You decide to mount it at 1.5 million miles, it'll sense excess gravity from the Earth, and it'll start accelerating toward the Earth. Mount it 1.5 million miles away from the Earth, and it'll sense the extra centripetal force of the Earth going around the Sun, and it'll move away from you. So that Lagrange point is very close to 1 million miles away. It's the one place where all the forces balance. It is a place of stability, but it is a negative stability point. It's like sitting on the top of a mountain. You don't tend to slide. Assume the mountaintop has got a very rounded curve to it, and you're in the middle of that curve. You're at a stable equilibrium point. You're at a somewhat stable point, but if you start moving a little bit to one side or the other, you'll keep moving. So Lagrange point number 3 and 5, I think it was 3 and 4, the ones that are 60 degrees ahead and 60 degrees behind the Earth, those are unconditionally stable. No matter which way you move, you'll get pushed back to the center. But Lagrange point number 2 is it's only partially stable, is my understanding. But that's where you got to be, otherwise you're going to burn up a whole lot of fuel doing station keeping. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
About 2 minutes, Dick.
Okay, yeah, 1 and 2 are good. A million miles in front of the Earth and a million miles behind the Earth. I'll turn it back to you, John, and Dick. I don't know where these 4 hours went. That's the end of SpaceNet number 160. Back to you, Dick, K2RIWW at 2.
Good stuff, Paul. And let's see now. Have I got this thing plugged in right? Yes, I think I do. You guys just heard TechNet number 1567. Isn't that amazing? Of the series that began in roughly September 1982. And, when Hippocrates, Hippocrates is the guy's name, yeah, and 2FDJ, I think his call letters were at the time, when he and I started this thing called TechNet, we thought it would last a month or so. We'd get people's questions answered, try them, go away. Here we are going on 33 years later, 32 and three-quarter years later. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. And try to enjoy this space stuff and this radio stuff. It'll never catch on. KC2WGB. Tie the ribbons on it, John. K2RIW. Bye-bye for now.
Very good, Dick. Enjoyable night. Very nice. Oh, by the way, Dick, those three pictures I sent you, in case you were wondering why, we were discussing a while back some of the jobs, and you were looking for descriptions. You'll see that you had asked me about the flash suit. That's one of the pictures I sent you with me in the flash suit. That's just giving an idea of what it looked like because I was trying to describe it to you. But I'd like to thank everybody for joining the net and participating. And love the questions that come in. And my email is Juliet Bravo, oscar@aol.com, and I will forward your questions. Thank you for everybody. I want to thank everybody again, and enjoy. Be kind. KC2WGB. Back to you.
See you guys later.
Thank you. 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
N2KZ, November 2 Kilo Zulu is N2KZ.
Gastronomic delicacies.
know that place. I'm trying to think of places on the water. I guess a lot have changed hands over the years.
Parkside is on Adler Court in Seaford, right by Seaford Town Dock. If you know where Seaford Town Dock is, it's right there. And the other place is just the very, very end of, I don't remember what the heck of the canal is. It's like a mile and a half long straight shot canal. Putting up that thing for like, you know, 25 minutes at 5 miles an hour.
Is that the canal where Dick and Dora's is?
Isn't Dick and Dora's a little further to the east in almost Amityville? I'm trying to remember where Dick and Dora's is.
That's on Alhambra. Don't have to speak one.
That's further east. That's further east. This was Forest Avenue, which wasn't that far into Massapequa. So yeah, this was Forest Avenue.
Oh, Forest Avenue. Okay, that's where the old head station is. That bowl right down the street from there. Okay. Yeah, it had a different name back then. I'm trying to think what the name was. Okay. It's always good to know where these places are at.
It's obvious that they probably got the poop beat out of them from Sandy, because the place looks like it's relatively newly built. But they have a real nice dock. They've got about 89 large slips. So there's no problem pulling there. Saturday night, there weren't even, you know, there were plenty of empty slips Saturday night when we got there. And Parkside, which was a bit of a smaller venue, but had a real nice outdoor eating area, and it was crowded, very crowded, so it obviously has a large following. They had about eight slips or so, and they weren't filled either. So again, if we decided to do a dinner cruise over that way, at least I know that there'd be a fair good chance of getting a spot and tying up.
Shut down, particularly on Long Beach.